And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon.
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
Phil, and it's today we're going to be talking with a very distinguished lawyer from London about the Charles Taylor case, Mr. Courtney Griffiths. And I recommend that you go to the Internet and magically acquire the transcripts of the trial. You see brilliant work. And we'll also be talking to Thomas Mountain in Eritrea, because we are following the story of in that region. Thomas has been writing in Counterpunch magazine about a growing crisis there in that area, particularly in Ethiopia, where the government seems to have almost disappeared, but happily being replaced by the CIA. It's the least they could do. And later in the program, we will talk to a professor from New York who has recently been in Zimbabwe. And that should do it. August 6th is the anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. August 9th is the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. And it's being marked in various places. Phil, you want to give us just quickly the date?
Yes, the Hiroshima Day Coalition. There's basically two events this week. On Thursday, August the 9th, Nagasaki Day at 6:15 p.m. at Holy Trinity Church. There's an event that has many sponsors. Please come out that night. And also at City Hall, between August 8th and the 11th, there'll be a photographic exhibit from Hiroshima.
Very good. Thank you very much. Our first guest is Courtney Griffiths, and he is, as I've already said, is a distinguished lawyer, many prominent cases. His work is studied by other lawyers as outstanding work, but he has been involved in a case of defending former President Charles Taylor of Liberia, and I really recommend that our listeners go to the trouble to locate the transcripts of that trial. If you want to see brilliant defense work, it is done there by Courtney Griffiths and is available. And I know we have very diligent listeners and they can find that. But we're happy to welcome now Mr. Courtney Griffiths. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. And good evening to you.
Good evening to you. I'm sorry we're keeping you up late, but you're probably watching the Olympics or the great sprinter Mr. Bolt is taking over the world at the moment.
Yes, I've been celebrating Jamaica's 50th anniversary and also celebrating our success on the track and field event.
Yeah, what a way to celebrate the 50th. Congratulations, everybody. Now, Mr. Griffiths, you have, as I was saying, you've had a long and a very successful and brilliant career in Britain and various other places. But you took on a particularly difficult case in that of Charles Taylor, the former president of Liberia. And I know that you've been reflecting on that. And I've seen, for example, in a publication, The New African, an article which you have written in which you international politics it played a role. Now, let me get the title right. The Politics of International Criminal Law. You had somewhat frustrated in your work there around the Charles Taylor case. What is the problem with, as you see it, with these tribunals?
I think the problem is that in this international criminal justice arena, power politics is allowed to play too great a role. And also, the second difficulty is that most of those who are put on trial, by the time they arrive in the courtroom, they've already been so vilified in the press that it's very difficult to secure a fair trial for them, because you first have to overcome what in many cases is decades of negative media reporting of events surrounding the trial of that individual. And you then have to lift the veil of that negativity and try and establish in the courtroom what precisely went on. And it means that one has to fight those cases, not only in the courtroom, but also in the public media.
Mm-hmm. Well, your client, it struck me, by the way, we were very proud of the fact that we once interviewed President Taylor during the crisis. And what I was struck by was that there was no evidence that he was not cooperating together with others to try to bring about a peaceful resolution of the armed fighting in the region, not only in Liberia, but the United States president demanded that he had to step down. Eventually, he agreed to do that. And there was a grave area there where many African leaders, I know, thought that it was understood that he was being very helpful in bringing about a peaceful resolution and therefore would not be prosecuted. But subsequently, he was arrested in Nigeria, where he had been a guest. Then he was passed to Liberia. Then he was passed to Sierra Leone. And then he ended up at The Hague. It seems to me he's got a very difficult matter to – who is he dealing with? He's dealing with Nigerians and his old country of Liberia, which didn't decide to prosecute him. How did he get handed along like that? It seems like an embarrassing international process.
It certainly was, because the fact is that Taylor decided to step down after a deal had been brokered involving the then British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, the President of the United States, George Bush, and indeed Kofi Annan, along with President Obasanjo of Nigeria. And the deal was, if he were to step down, he would be offered asylum in Nigeria, and effectively the legal proceedings against him in the Special Court for Sierra Leone would fade into the background. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is that for some reason, George Bush decided that he didn't want to honor that agreement, and effectively they wanted to put Taylor on trial. And you see, it's the politics surrounding that decision which intrigues me, because it seems to me, and it's something that I've said on previous occasions, that there is a strategy afoot at present by certain Western powers to use international criminal law, and indeed the ICC, as an instrument to, in effect, put the fear of God into certain third world leaders, that if they step out of line, this is what will happen to you. You will be hauled off to The Hague in chains and put on trial and branded a criminal. Mm-hmm. And of course, once you've been so branded, you lose all political legitimacy. And, you know, at one level, you see that going on in Syria now with the Assad regime. I'm not here to defend the Assad regime, but if the aftermath of what happened in Libya with the regime change agenda, which became paramount during the NATO offensive, if that experience is anything to go by, we may well be creating a further nightmare in the Middle East if the West continues to support Assad's opponent and not seek to broker some kind of deal which will ensure some peaceful resolution of the conflict in that country. And that's a major concern.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I get the impression that that it actually, and it continues to create problems for the country in which these events take place. For example, the tribunals always use the phrase, we're ending the culture of impunity. However, in the case of Liberia, I notice there's a gentleman named Prince Johnson. I've read about him. He seems somewhat a criminal, at least in public record. What happened to the move against the culture of impunity?
Well, that's another aspect of my critique of international criminal justice, that it's very selective, that even on the African continent, the use of the criminal justice system to end impunity is very selective indeed. So, for example, there is very clear evidence collected by international bodies that certain governments in East Africa are directly intervening in the conflict in eastern Congo and are benefiting economically and financially as a result. And yet one doesn't hear the kind of criticism directed at them as you have directed against the like of Colonel Gaddafi and others. Now, I'm all for the ending of impunity, but my idea is that the law should treat everyone equally. inquiry that whether you're the President of the United States of America or the President of Liberia, if you commit wrong, then you should be brought to book. But the problem with that scenario, that idyllic scenario, is that the West is not ready to accept some kind of universal criminal jurisdiction over their actions, which is why the late Robin Cook, the then British Foreign Minister, after the United Kingdom signed up to the Rome Treaty, which created the International Criminal Court, was asked on BBC Newsnight whether it now meant that Tony Blair and George Bush could be put on trial for the illegal war in Iraq. And he turned on his interrogator indignantly and said, "This is not a court set up to try the likes of the Prime Minister of England or President of the United States." So what does that tell you? Yeah. That certain powerful, rich countries are immune from this kind of criminal jurisdiction. Whereas if you're the leader of a poor, troubled country like Liberia, then you can easily be hauled off to The Hague and put on trial. And as a lawyer, I find that kind of differential treatment totally unacceptable.
Yes. Well, now, by the way, I mean, that for you must be one of the great challenges. And I know near the conclusion of the trial, you were found yourself being put on a very difficult choice in which you had to tell the court you didn't accept their decision that you could not enter your final brief. After years and years of a case, they suddenly decided they had to have this, and otherwise you couldn't present it. And you chose to not cooperate at that point, and they decided to cite you. And one other detail to this, as this all worked through, there was a judge there who said he wasn't happy either. What about going, your advice to other lawyers? I mean, looking at these things, how far can you cooperate with a court that doesn't seem to be too interested in the dotting the I's and crossing the T's of due process?
Well, I think as a lawyer, one certainly has a duty to ensure that you cooperate fully with the tribunal before whom you're appearing, because dispensing justice isn't the sole duty of the judge. All the other parties involved in the proceedings have a part to play in providing justice to those who appear before it. And if it comes to the point where you as a lawyer feel that you cannot properly defend the interest of your client by continuing to cooperate with a tribunal, then I think you have a moral and indeed an ethical duty to withdraw. Mm-hmm. And I think in withdrawing from those proceedings when they refused to accept our final written brief because we're a few days old, mm-hmm. a few days late in filing it, was totally unacceptable. And particularly in light of the fact that we were only a couple of weeks overdue in proceedings which had lasted at that time almost 4 years. Mm-hmm. And then to rub salt into the wound, having been promised that the verdicts would be brought out in or about the autumn of 2011, we have to wait until April of this year to have a verdict. So the very judges who were criticizing us for being a few weeks late themselves took over a year, having sat throughout those proceedings for 3.5 years. Why did they need an additional 13 months or so to arrive at a verdict? So, you know, I find that I cannot understand that kind of double standard. Mm-hmm. And so I feel totally justified in the action that I took at the time, because I felt it was the only way I could properly protect Mr. Taylor's interest as his lawyer.
Yeah. And by the way, during this point, you brought the evidence, or there was evidence produced by a British newspaper, The Guardian, that something your client had raised, which was that he was the victim of colluding of a major power, that the United States, in trying to achieve political ends against him. And I think they found cables to exactly that effect. the use of legal procedure to try to bring down Mr. Taylor as president.
Yes, well, that is the case, because shortly before we were due to file our final closing brief, we had the WikiLeaks disclosures. And amongst the thousands of code cables which were released, there were a few which directly had a bearing on the proceedings against Mr. Taylor. One in particular stands out. It was a cable from the then U.S. ambassador to Liberia, to the State Department in the United States, saying in effect that they were fearful that Taylor might be acquitted in The Hague, or even if convicted, would receive a light sentence, and that consequently the U.S. government should consider taking steps to have him removed to the United States and put on trial there, so that he could be given the almost 100-year sentence that his son Chucky received in Florida. But I don't think it's the first time we've seen international criminal proceedings being used in that strategic way by major powers. You will recall that at the height of the NATO intervention in Libya, the Security Council announced that an arrest warrant ought to be issued for Colonel Gaddafi and his son Saif, and also his then intelligence minister. And the then chief prosecutor of the ICC, Luis Moreno Ocampo, was quick to jump on that and issue an arrest warrant. Following Gaddafi's assassination, now that Saif Gaddafi was in the custody of one of the rebel groups in Libya, Luis Moreno Ocampo, even though the Libyan legal system was in total ruin, suddenly announced that he would be quite happy if Saif was tried in Libya, knowing full well that he couldn't receive a fair trial there. And lo and behold, a few weeks ago, when the defense office at the ICC, taking up their responsibilities, went out to Libya to see what is a potential arrestee of that court, they themselves were arrested by the current Libyan authorities and held under house arrest for several weeks. Now, one wonders why there was this sudden change of position by the chief prosecutor. What prompted it at a time when bringing legal proceedings against Gaddafi could aid in the war effort by delegitimizing him? All of a sudden, whilst the country lay in ruins, suddenly changed his position and was suggesting that he could receive a fair trial there. And one sees behind that the hidden hand of international diplomacy. And until we can separate what happens in the courtroom from the national and economic interests of certain powerful countries, we can't call this justice at all. It doesn't deserve that label.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that there have been more and more lawyers, of course, because of these many cases now we're getting of these so-called ad hoc and special courts. There are defense counsel beginning to meet and discuss these things. I understand you might be speaking, I think, in Montreal, and there's been some meetings in London. Do you get an idea that maybe lawyers are beginning to spread the word that they have a little crisis on their hands about how these tribunals are run?
Well, I hope so. I hope that the veil is now being lifted and that, in particular, defense lawyers engaged in these tribunals now see precisely what is going on in these proceedings and recognize that they have to play a dual role in this situation, that they cannot rely purely on the technical legal skills within the courtroom. But there is a wider battle to be fought here, because creating a proper international criminal justice system is going to require a great deal of hard work, a great deal of campaigning, a great deal of protest. If it is to live up to its ideal, it needs a lot more imagination than many lawyers are currently demonstrating in those forums.
Hmm. a troubling thought. This is Mr. Courtney Griffiths, and he acted as counsel for President, former President Charles Taylor of Libya, pardon me, Liberia. Now, Mr. Griffiths, you talked about, you had certainly a heavy demonization process, which is an uphill battle for a counsel. Now we've had the headlines and all the editorials, certainly in Canada, said guilty as charged. Is that what the court said, really, at the end of the case?
No, it's not. One has to recognize that effectively there were three bases upon which this prosecution against Taylor was laid. The first and primary basis, which was the true objective of the prosecution, was to prove that he was party to what they call in those tribunals the joint criminal enterprise, but in our common law systems, is better understood by the use of the word conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But Taylor was involved in a conspiracy with Colonel Gaddafi and other West African leaders to take over West Africa and criminally exploit its resources. Mm. The judges rejected that proposition out of hand.
Out of hand. Good.
Yeah, out of hand. They said there was no evidence whatsoever to support it. Now, the second basis was that Taylor had command responsibility. That is, he was micromanaging the combatant forces in Sierra Leone. Mm. Again, the judges rejected that. He was convicted on the basis that he was aiding and abetting the rebel forces in Sierra Leone by supplying them with arms and ammunition and other material support, and also on occasions giving them advice as to strategy and tactics. Now, that's the basis, the narrow basis upon which he was convicted. But as a very prominent international jurist commented, if that's the basis of Taylor's conviction, then one has to wonder about the criminal liability of, for example, the United States in Nicaragua in supporting the Contras, mm-hmm. and the United States in Afghanistan when they supported the Mujahideen against the then occupying forces of the Soviet Union. That kind of assistance to combatant groups has been part of diplomatic and strategic thinking for centuries. That's precisely what is going on in Syria today. Everybody knows that Turkey and Saudi Arabia, amongst others, are supporting the rebels in Syria. So they're doing precisely what Taylor did in Sierra Leone for their own strategic political ends. Why are there no crimes in the aftermath of the Taylor verdict for them to be put on trial? Because they're doing exactly the same thing. And this brings me back to the salient point which I'm seeking to establish, that it's all about politics. And it's all about what powerful countries in this world want to achieve. In those situations, no one points the finger of criminality at their actions. That is reserved for leaders of minor countries who happen to be, whose removal is in the interest of powerful countries in the West. And that's not law. Mm-hmm. That's selectivity. That's politics.
Yeah, and I suppose, since all the accused in all these tribunals are Africans, it kind of looks like colonialism to me. I don't know. I've been looking for the right word, but I don't see. I mean, they do say openly that the courts don't apply to them. The United States says, of course, we would never surrender an American to any one of these courts.
And in fact, the United States has gone further and has signed bilateral treaties with many countries around the world to the effect that they will not receive any aid or military assistance from the United States unless they sign these agreements, which prohibit them from handing over a U.S. national to any international tribunal. But, of course, that's understandable. If the United States takes upon itself the mantle of becoming the world policeman, and given its military might with a military as big as the next 10 biggest militaries in the world combined. If you have such a military empire and you take upon yourself the right to intervene in any country around the world, the last thing you want is for your GIs to run the risk of being captured and sent to an international tribunal to be put on trial. Mm-hmm. So it's logical that the United States should adopt such a position. They can't afford to do otherwise.
Yes. Well, now, and President Taylor, and he made a rather nice summarizing statement at the end of the case. He pointed out something which I want your thoughts about, too. You just outlined the fact that the U.S. has said, no, not only will we not have an American in front of this court, but neither will anybody we signed bilateral agreements with. And yet, I went to the first day of your trial, and the prosecutor was one Stephen Rapp of the United States. And at the end of the trial was a U.S. A former U.S. Air Force colonel. I forget her name. These are all American leading the prosecution.
That's part of the ironies of this situation, that here we have the most powerful country on the planet refusing to subject itself to any kind of international jurisdiction, and yet supplying the counsel and the most significant counsel in all of the tribunals around the world, whether it be at the ICTY, the Yugoslav Tribunal, Special Court for Sierra Leone, or elsewhere. I mean, doesn't people see a degree of hypocrisy in that?
You know, I have to ask you that. The matter of the U.S. making these decisions, wouldn't a proper court say, you know, you're in contempt of our court by counseling people not to cooperate with us?
In technical terms, that must be right. But then, how do you enforce such a decision by a court that the United States is in contempt of their proceedings by persuading others not to hand over their nationals? I mean, let's just consider this scenario, for example. Quite recently, a U.S. Star Sergeant in Afghanistan went amok and slaughtered a number of Afghans and burnt their bodies. And he was quickly whisked off to the United States for trial there. What do you think the U.S. government's reaction would have been had, say, the Taliban got hold of him, handed him over to another country, who then in turn handed him over to the ICC in The Hague? There's no way Washington could have countenanced that, which is why George Bush passed the American Servicemen's Act, which gives the U.S. government the power to militarily invade Holland if one of their nationals are put on trial. One can see how important the United States government takes such a scenario.
Mm-hmm. You can see why Madeleine Albright says, after all, they are the indispensable country.
Exactly. Exactly. Meaning, in effect, we are above the law.
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Courtney Griffiths, it's wonderful talking to you. It's been very enlightening. I do really urge people. I thought you did wonderful work, and all people have to do is go to Prosecutor versus Charles Taylor, and they can see those transcripts, and not the in-between transcripts, but the actual transcripts. It was wonderful work. We thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to seeing you in Canada.
And thank you for having me on your program.
Okay, no. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good evening.
Good evening. And that was Courtney Griffiths. And he did do a brilliant job, and I really recommend it. I mean, and I have to emphasize this over and over. Transcripts do not take the summary. There's all sorts of universities and human rights bodies that are seeing fit to tell you about the trial. That is not the trial. They're telling you, and that is not. You will lose a lot if you don't go directly to the actual transcript. Because the summaries, if you want a good laugh, a belly laugh, look at some of these law schools that are providing summaries of the case. And you read the transcript and then read the summary, and you will laugh out loud. So, anyway, again, we were very grateful to speak to Courtney Griffiths, and this is, you're listening to the Taylor Report at CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and check us on the web at taylor-report.com. We'll take a break. We'll come back with the mountain. And we're back, just like I warned you, the Taylor Report. And I guess we did say at the top, good for Usain Bolt. We hope, wish him luck in the 200. And the only while we're waiting for Mr. Thomas Mountain to talk about the situation in Eritrea, I'll just say that, you know, you want shocking sports news. The biggest shocking sports news on the Olympics is that the United States did not qualify in any of the weight classes in boxing for the first time in Olympic history, modern Olympic history. Now, it's extraordinary. And it tells you something about race in America and business interfering in the affairs of sport. America used to have a wonderful assortment of fighters, and they always did well, but something has gone seriously amiss. It's kind of like, you know, they worry about the bees are missing, and then they say maybe the the American boxers are missing. And I'll tell you where they are. They're all in prison. And we're joined now by Thomas Mountain. Are you there, Thomas?
Yes.
Hey, thanks very much. You're very patient with us. I know we kept you up late. We seem to have everybody up late tonight. We have been following events in your region, and recently we had a guest who told us that the government of Ethiopia seems to have almost, it seems to be, let's put it this way, it's in a coma. What the heck is going on in Ethiopia?
Well, you know, first of all, your listeners probably ought to know that Ethiopia is the United States' policeman on the beat in East Africa. Numerically, they've got the largest and inventory-wise the best-equipped army in Africa. You know, the United States foreign policy is based on a policy of using as much as possible local enforcers or policemen on the beat. In South America, they've got Colombia doing their dirty work. In West Africa, they've got Nigeria. In the Middle East, they've got Israel. And in East Africa, their main enforcer is Ethiopia. So Ethiopia is pretty critical to the United States in terms of controlling the region. And, of course, particularly the Horn of Africa is now the transit point for almost something like 60% of the world's trade. There's been a dramatic shift in geopolitical shift in the last 5 years where major trade partners in the world are no longer North America and Asia. It's now Asia and Europe. So every day, hundreds of container ships with the majority of the world's commerce is passing through not only the Suez Canal, guarded by a mercenary Egyptian army, but the Horn of Africa through the Bab al-Mandeb, the straits between the Red Sea and the Indian Ocean. So the United States has been relying upon Ethiopia to do its dirty work in the region, and their main mafia enforcer has been one Melis Zenawi, a former Marxist guerrilla fighter, now turned G20 diplomat. Now, for almost 2 months now, Melis Zenawi has been out of sight. I mean, nobody knows where he is. And there's been a lot of questions raised about his health. And the best I can tell from the sources that I trust, Melis Zenawi is actually in a coma now. He's been sick and fallen into a coma. We don't know for sure, but this is the thing that really tipped the balance of all this is the fact that now the United States, well, basically the CIA media handlers and high-ranking diplomats have been approaching the Ethiopian resistance and saying, offering major inducements if they will participate in what they're calling a transitional government. And they're telling people, oh, Melis is quote-unquote sick, and that they need to set up a transitional government until the next elections in 2015. Which to me is pretty much a de facto admission that Melis is in the coma that people are claiming.
Yeah. Now, just to ask you, and this is Thomas Mountain. By the way, you find Thomas in Counterpunch, many very trenchant commentaries on the situation in the region. We're hearing also that there's some sort of atmospheric change and a much more in a more aggressive policy to be coming from the United States and Britain primarily, I suppose, towards Eritrea and also of sort of a changing confrontation there with problems in Kenya. Can you talk about that?
Well, the whole Horn of Africa region, which some people include Kenya in that, has been pretty explosive. I mean, of course, everything's very calm and peaceful here in Eritrea, but the rest of the region has been, you know...
Stormy.
Destabilized and stormy. But Kenya in particular is an area that's like a powder keg about to go off. I mean, you know, you can start with the traditional rivalry in Kenya where the largest tribe is the Luo tribe, and who have not had power. The British basically installed the Kikuyu, headed by the Kenyatta regime, at independence. And they're an ethnic minority government. And they've monopolized power and monopolized control of the wealth of Kenya. And every election, they steal the election because they're a minority. They're not supposed to win. The Luo is supposed to win. And in every election, it's been getting more and more violent. Now, these are the Highlanders in Kenya.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's the question of the Muslim minority on the coast around Mombasa. Now, historically, Mombasa was actually governed by the Sultan of Zanzibar. So there's supposed to have been a deal made between Kenyatta and the Sultan of Zanzibar that turned over Mombasa to the Kenyan control at independence. Now, the Highlanders, mainly the Kikuyu, presently headed by the party, headed by Mbaki, President Mbaki, they basically come in and marginalized the people on the coast and kept them from any sort of economic or political advancement. And the Muslim, this is mainly a Muslim community on the coast. The Highlanders mm-hmm. are mainly traditional and Christians. Mm-hmm. The Muslims on the coast are fed up with it all. And, they're saying, look, why should we continue to allow Highlanders to come down here and take over everything and we don't get anything? Mm-hmm. On top of that, there's questions about, because some of the biggest hotel in Africa is in Kenya, along the coast, mm-hmm. the major hotel industry there, and all the land that those hotels are sitting on is reportedly owned by the president of Kenya and his immediate family and close supporters.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a second, all this beachfront land in Kenya was just basically appropriated by the high-ranking government officials and then turned around and leased out to these hotels? So, I mean, there's big problems in Kenya, and
yeah.
The election was supposed to be scheduled for December, and it's been postponed now. They're not really talking about it much, but, I'm getting reports that there's an uptick in arms purchases by Kenyans
yeah.
in Somalia. So, in other words, the Kenyan, the Kikuyu, and the Luo are
yes.
preparing to get back at each other's throats again.
What a happy picture. And, of course, the British and Americans are minding their own business, as they usually do.
Well, the thing is, it's not just Kenya, because the from Mombasa, the trade route runs through Kenya up into Uganda, supplying you the economies are keeping, the economies of Uganda, Rwanda, Burundi, and even South Sudan are dependent on the Mombasa trade. And this all passes through the Rift Valley in Kenya's highlands. Well, then the last election in 2007, there was a... major outbreak of fighting, a couple of thousand people killed, hundreds of thousands of, ethnic cleansing carried out by the Luo against their traditional rivals, the Kikuyu. And the economies of Uganda basically shut down. Gasoline shot up to something like $10 a liter, and, the economies there shut down. So all this talk about oil wealth and oil pipelines from South Sudan, from Kenya, this is all going to go up in smoke if the Kenyans don't come to sort of a power-sharing deal within their government. But see, the problem is if the Kikuyu cheat in the next election and steal the election, there's a chance that the Luo leaders headed by this Endinga are not going to be able to control their own people. And,
mm-hmm.
The last election, people were killing each other with knives, machetes. This time around, they're buying weapons on the Somali black market, and there's talk about an armed conflict breaking out with weapons. So,
well,
Kenya is potentially an explosive area.
Mm-hmm.
you know, there's been praise as the economic powerhouse of the region. The reality is Kenya is probably one of the most corrupt governments in Africa, if not the world. So, you know, Kenya's a powder keg, and of course, the United States is playing a role in, you know, trying to bid destabilize
the
Sudan.
But the government they want to bring down is the government where you are. They're bringing sanctions.
Right. Well,
I don't know of any sanctions.
Someone else to blame. Elsewhere. They're always looking for someone to blame for their own mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Eritrea, Eritrea is the one economic success story in the region, where we've got the fastest growing economy in Africa. The standard of living of the population is rising steadily, and that you know, it's the one of the only countries in Africa that's scheduled to meet the Millennium Development Goals of the United Nations.
But it does have a shortage of Western NGOs, which it obviously has to be corrected.
Yes, a deliberate shortage. Eritrea has pretty much kicked all the NGOs out, along with the United Nations peacekeepers. And, you know, Eritrea's policy is one of self-reliance. And Eritrea's got one of the lowest levels of debt in the world. Even though the country has been
another
crime. A lot of economic. Pardon?
Another crime, according to the World Bank. You're supposed to be deeply in debt.
That's right.
To show you're an enterprising.
The banksters don't like that, and it's a kind of a role model when you're not deeply in debt and you've got the fastest growing economy in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, of course, the national motto here in Eritrea is never kneel down. So they say Eritreans kneel for two things. To pray and to shoot, and they're not going to kneel down and kiss the feet of Pax Americana. So yes, they've been.
That's, you know, that sounds like a good political program.
Well, you know, it maintains a very peaceful and beautiful place to live. I really like living in Asmara. We can walk the streets safely. There's almost no crime here, and you know, the people are overwhelmingly supportive of their president. You know, interestingly enough, Eritrea is the only country in Africa that doesn't have elections. And yet we've got the fastest growing economy and the most peaceful and united people in the country, in the continent.
Well, I'm sure that the U.S. can find a way to solve that. Now, Thomas, I got to ask you in the time remaining, because you have been publishing really wonderful pieces in Counterpunch, and we just lost the main figure at Counterpunch. I know they're continuing, bless their hearts, but can you tell us something about what it's like to have known and worked with Alexander Coburn?
Yeah, you know, I used to be a lifelong resident of Hawaii. I was what they call a Kama'aina, born and raised there. In the course of my 40 years of political activity there, so I hosted the last three visits to Hawaii by Alexander Coburn, and co-hosted. Alex is actually a close friend of some of the leadership of the Kanaka Ba'oli, or the Native Hawaiian movement,
mm-hmm.
in Hawaii, going way back until the 80s. You know, Alex was... it's almost painful for me to think about all the times Alex sort of pulled me back onto the right road. I mean, for example, Kosovo, when when the Western intervention was being initiated, I was really confused about the whole matter, and was kind of being dazed and confused by the Western media propaganda, and Alex yanked me back. Alex has been, you know, just a few paragraphs of clarity so many times, you know, made things gave us some direction, and it was a very painful loss. You know, they kept it, you know, secret that he was sick with cancer,
mm-hmm.
and when he went, it was like boom, it was a blow to a lot of us. Now, you know, it's interesting. I've read some really nasty things about Alex. That just obviously these people didn't know the guy, and maybe it's because they were jealous because Counterpunch has become such a huge website, and some of their work just doesn't cut it anymore, and. The Counterpunch doesn't publish it. Now, you know, Alex, I just found him to be a really, I never regretted a minute I spent around him. And I spent, you know, he'd come out for a couple of weeks at a time, and we spent a great deal of quality time together. So, mm-hmm. you know, Alex was a brilliant political scientist and a journalist extraordinaire. You know, I rate him right there next to Noam Chomsky in terms of his political analysis.
Yes.
And,
Well, when you think about it, he worked with Chomsky, Ralph Nader, and Edward Said. That's a pretty great company, and they regarded him as a peer.
Well, you know, Alex was came out of the '60s. He was only 71 when he passed, and so you know, he worked for outfits like the Village Voice, and even was writing for the Wall Street Journal for a while. And you know, he set up the Counterpunch website, which he let his co-editors pretty much run. Alex was the main most popular contributor to it with his weekly column.
Yes.
But, you know, so it's been in Jeffrey St. Clair's hands for a while. And, you know, Jeffrey's the one that gets up every morning at 3 o'clock and goes through the thousands of emails that come in and chooses the, you know, the best of the articles that come in. So, you know, it's in very website's in very competent hands. I don't know if... Mm-hmm. If we'll ever be able, anybody ever be able to replace Alex. But, you know, I'm going to have to write an article about how Alex was, Africa lost a friend, because in 2009, Alex contacted me and said, look, you got to write about Darfur. You got to write, you're there in the Horn of Africa. You got to start writing about this stuff. Yeah, he'd known me since the 1980s, and he was saying, look, and he started sending me articles in the United States and pushing me, so I started writing about Darfur. And then Alex made sure my articles got published on Counterpunch. And Counterpunch is one of the largest independent websites in the world. It's right up there at the top in the United States, and it stands unsurpassed as a credible, independent, you know, journalist site. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, even around South Sudan, Alex pushed me about South Sudan. It was a very depressing subject. I didn't want to write about it, but Alex pushed me, and I wrote about it. So, you know, he's, and then he made sure that there was not only that he, you know, encouraged and pushed me to write, but it got published, and it, you know, got out there to potentially millions of readers through his site. And
certainly did
helped me pick up a major African audience, because that independent African websites began running my articles, and now I've got, you know, my column runs in. And people have told me that I'm the most widely distributed independent journalist in Africa now.
Wow! So, you've underlined an accomplishment that you share with Alexander Coburn, because it was his initiative.
Yep. You know, loss of Alex is, I think, it was a blow, and I couldn't even write about it. I finally did a little bit, but I've just going back, the memories are almost too painful. But
Well, I tell you, we look forward to your commentary. We know we're going to see a lot of it about him, but you've really underlined how important that site is, and we want to underline how great it is that to have you as a guest and all of us to have Counterpunch. So thanks, Thomas, very, very much. We have to go.
Okay, Phil. Take care. Ciao.
All right. Bye-bye. Thomas Mountain. I fell back and was looking at the ceiling, forgot there's a microphone here. Ah, yes, this is the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. We're going to be talking with Pauline Bullen. She is from New York, a professor in, I think it's a state university, New York State University, Brooklyn. If Phil, you might know about such things. You've been known to be in and out of.
There is such a place.
There is such a place. So that this is proof that this is a real McCoy. This is CIUT 89.5 FM. Write to us, Taylor at CIUT.FM. And I think we are joined by Pauline Bullen. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thank you for being patient. We were a cluster of interviews today, and we are very anxious to talk to you. You are a professor at
Brooklyn College.
Brooklyn College.
Yes, with City University.
And it's and you, of course, have, I gather, some special interest in Africa. I know you traveled there recently, and I would want to ask you about that. You were in Zimbabwe, and why were you there, and what did you make of the country?
I was there actually as a visiting scholar. There is a women's university that is in Zimbabwe.
A women's university?
A women's university, yes. One of the only women's universities, I think, in the world, mm-hmm. that is located in Zimbabwe.
Uh-huh.
And I had an opportunity to actually go there and spend 2 months doing some work in the women's program at that school.
Mm-hmm. The press here is, I have to say, so negative when we hear about Zimbabwe. They only report they seem to have an editorial policy. If it's something negative about either Robert Mugabe or the country, they go with it. We never hear anything about, well, what's the atmosphere like in the country? What are the people thinking about? Priorities? And what's the impression do you get?
Well, I found it actually to be quite a beautiful country, with people who are extremely resourceful, particularly after the sanctions that have been imposed on the country, after the redistribution of land. Mm-hmm. And, the amount of sanctions that affected the medical system, their ability to have just the basic medicine, food, food and basic necessities. And then with the hyperinflation that occurred in 2008, where people just became desperately poor. So during my time, what I heard a lot of were people talking about 2008 and their fear that those conditions would reoccur.
Mm-hmm.
So you have people who are spending U.S. dollars now very carefully, afraid to put their money into the banks. Mm-hmm. So you have money, U.S. dollars, circulating to the extent where they literally fall apart because they become so old and dirty, going from one hand to the other.
Yes.
But people are extremely resourceful. You have professional women and men have their own land where they farm, and they make arrangements to sell what they produce, mm-hmm. To supplement their income. The university reached out to educate women. That was one of the country's priorities, to grow that leadership and to really focus on developing the education, making sure that people become well-educated. What I see, which I find it really ironic, is the U.S. Embassy in Zimbabwe being very active in recruiting some of the brightest minds from the countryside, mm-hmm. And they proudly state that they take that some of their best scholarship candidates come from the villages and come from the countryside, and these young people get scholarships to go to Yale and Harvard and MIT and various U.S. schools.
Yes.
In some ways, I think, of course, people see that as a good. And in some ways, of course, it is draining some of the brightest minds, and recolonizing some of the brightest minds too. Mm-hmm. I think in some ways, I had an opportunity to meet some incredible people. I met a lot of artists. There's a lot of fabulous art that is coming out of the country, despite the fact that many of the people don't have the resources to work with. Mm-hmm. So they are creative. I've been sporting earrings, for example, that were made out of bottle caps and with painted images of the countryside on those bottle capped earrings. I saw the work of a group of women, the Waya artists, and who were written up recently in the BBC News about their particular work, because they come together as a collective and they create quilts. Mm-hmm. That show their, the life of the country. People are finding extremely creative ways. I mean, and one of the things that many people are proud of is the fact that they are growing tobacco. They are farming the land. Mm-hmm. Small farmers are producing crops, even because, through teaching themselves farming. Yes. And it's a real system of teach one that occurs mm-hmm. in that country.
Yeah. By the way, we're speaking to Pauline Bullen. She's from Brooklyn College, and she's been recently within Zimbabwe. And, when they decided on land reform,
mm-hmm.
the West responded, particularly Britain, in a really hostile way. And a lot of their economic problems came as a result of a kind of blackmail that they had to abandon it. How do the people of, the people of Zimbabwe feel about that big decision? Because that was a big step to introduce land reform.
I think that that many of the people saw it as necessary, because you had the majority of the land of the country being being controlled within a very small minority of people. And so I think that many people saw it as a necessary move towards, you know, allowing the indigenous people to be able to control their wealth and to control their, you know, their own economy.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, in many ways, people love Mugabe for that, mm-hmm. appreciate that opportunity to be able to control their own resources.
I've heard that South Africans, many South Africans, are asking their government, why don't you do what Robert Mugabe was able to do in Zimbabwe?
Exactly. You know, I traveled to Cape Town and Johannesburg, and I was shocked at the way black folk are living in those areas and the fact that that economy is clearly still, you know, well-controlled by the, you know, by the colonialists, by the whites who live in that country,
mm-hmm.
you know, and enjoy a real high standard of life when you have black folk who are afraid to walk into certain areas of the country, who are extremely poor, who are living on, you know, below what we would call a minimum wage. I mean, even in Zimbabwe, there are, you know, there are people who are surviving on $100 a month, mm-hmm. U.S. dollars. And having to find ways to survive because, you know, some people are still so poor and having to struggle so hard to be able to just make a living.
Mm-hmm. But comparing them, you would say that the Zimbabwe population is doing as well or at least in a more stable condition than their neighbors in South Africa.
From what I could see, yes.
Yeah.
You know, from what I can see and from what I could research, that would be the case. Certainly the quality of life, you know, Zimbabwean people I found have a certain fortitude. They have a resilience and a fabulous sense of humor. Mm-hmm. So I loved being there. I loved the country. I felt safe. I felt embraced. I felt that I had, you know, coming from New York and going there to work, I felt that my work that I was able to do in the short time was valued. I was able to really work with lecturers at the university to help them to develop their curriculum, and it was really a fulfilling experience. And I was working amongst people who were really hungry, asking a lot of questions, wanting to learn ways that they could develop their program. And I saw that at every level of the society, you know, a proud people, mm-hmm. a resilient people, and really resourceful and hardworking.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's wonderful. I'm really glad you could share all this. This is Pauline Bolin. She's a professor at Brooklyn College. And maybe we could talk again in the future sometime. There are many more questions I'd like to get to on Zimbabwe. And we thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. I wanted to mention that there is a Zimbabwean artist who lives in Ottawa who will be visiting Toronto and doing an artist talk, and his work speaks to the spirituality of the people.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be doing an artist talk in August, on August 25th, at the Band Gallery on Bloor Street West.
August the 25th?
Yes.
And
Bloor Street West, 823A Bloor Street West.
Well, thank you very much. We're going to make sure we will continue to advertise that, and thank you for being our guest. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the time. Bye-bye.
Pauline. Bye-bye. That's Pauline Bolin. And we're really glad we got to her because definitely Zimbabwe can't get a fair shake in this in our media. It's vilified continually. It speaks to our first guest, Mr. Courtney Griffiths, who pointed out that the powers in the West can demonize someone, and they cannot catch a break because the whole storyline has to be about how bad they are. Well, we're sorry to say this is August the 6th, the date of the bombing of Hiroshima, and we hope that people will look for the various events that are taking place around our city and around the world to commemorate that terrible moment because we need a peace movement right now to see to it that it doesn't, that no such things happen in the future. So thanks, Carol. Thanks, Phil Conlon. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. See you next week.